Support for this podcast and the following message come from PwC, pairing the right tech with the right solutions to help you gain a competitive edge, reimagine operations, fuel innovation, and detect risks. Human-led and tech-powered. It's all part of the new equation from PwC.
Hey, it's Guy here. So there are so many complex problems out there, and most of the time, we think they require complex solutions. But what if some of those problems could be solved by simple answers, staring us in the face? Well, on this episode, how sometimes the best solutions are the most simple ones. It's called Simple Solutions, and it originally aired in November of 2017. This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. What does simplicity mean to you?
Simplicity for me is something that performs its function in a very simple manner. So it's really effective. A smart product need not be something that's high tech, you know. So for me, that's the definition of simplicity.
This is Maleha Saneji. Maleha's an industrial designer. And she takes ordinary things like vegetable peelers or bookshelves, and she tries to make them better and simpler. But some of her earliest ideas when Maleha was still in school were maybe her most personal.
So it started actually from, we had a course in our study, which was designed for special needs. And that's usually what they tell you, that you can take any special need that you want to work on, and we will guide you with principles and guidance on how to do it.
So Maleha immediately thought of her uncle, who was struggling with Parkinson's.
Yeah, I think tremors were quite a prominent thing for him. He had to use a walker to walk, so sometimes, even on flat land, he needed help sometimes, so his wife was always next to him. Combined with that, he also had osteoporosis. So if he fell, it would take way longer for his bones to heal. Slowly, even his speech changed. So sometimes you couldn't understand what exactly he was saying. So for me, those were really shocking things. And I saw it deteriorate. Of course, it was over years.
Yeah.
But still, it was quite drastic suddenly. Yeah.
So you're thinking, I am not a med student. I am not going to be able to cure Parkinson's. But maybe there's something else I can do.
Yeah, since there is no cure right now for Parkinson's, I was really like, okay, how can I make his everyday life simple? And that was my goal, to find his everyday problems, things he does, and try to solve them. I guess I have always preferred simple solutions. So that was maybe something at the back of my head always, and that's why I did not choose to design one big complicated solution, but target his small needs and target different products or solutions towards it.
Today on the show, ideas about how complex problems are often solved by simple solutions. Sometimes even the ones staring right at you, the elegant answers that don't require lots of money or technology. So we're going to explore some of those solutions, like how to make schools better for kids, or how to prevent disease with very little effort. Or in the case of Maleha Saneji, how to improve the day-to-day life of her uncle, especially as the symptoms of his Parkinson's got worse and worse. Maleha picks up the story from the TED stage.
Well, the first thing I targeted was tremors, right? My uncle told me that he had stopped drinking coffee or tea in public just out of embarrassment. So, well, I designed the no-spill cup. It works just purely on its form. The curve on top deflects the liquid back inside every time they have tremors. And this keeps the liquid inside compared to a normal cup. But the key here is that it is not tagged as a Parkinson's patient product. It looks like a cup that could be used by you, me, any clumsy person. And that makes it much more comforting for them to use, to blend in.
So the shape of the actual cup is like what?
Yeah, it's actually like an urn.
An urn,
so
yeah.
So it's broad on top and curved. And towards the bottom, it's way narrower. And so it's almost like an apple shape.
I think it looks like a pear, like an upside down pear.
Yes.
Right?
Pear, yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. So it's like an upside down pear. And then there's like a wide handle on it. So you can put four of your fingers in it. Yeah.
Yes, four, and the thumb goes on the other side. So actually, the cup also has grooves on it that indicate that, hey, your fingers go here. So it's in a subtle way telling you where your fingers sit. So that was also a key detail that I thought to add so that they don't hold the handle, because it's very natural for a person to go straight for the handle.
Yeah.
But the idea was, no, this handle goes around your palm and you hold the cup. So.
And is it made out of ceramic?
No, because ceramic is something that could break.
Yeah.
So psychologically, they avoid those cups.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to make it really just plastic.
It's okay. So you designed this cup, which is very simple. I mean, I guess the idea is that because it's shaped like an upside down pear, it's harder for the liquid to spill out.
Yeah, the liquid keeps going up and down, but the curve keeps deflecting it back inside. But the key here was also that it did not look like a cup that was, you know, designed for a special
disabled
need.
Person.
It
yeah.
was really designed yeah. for all, for any clumsy person. And that was really also a key, because frankly, my uncle or any Parkinson's patient could use a sipper, right? Like a baby sipper.
Yeah.
You're like, why do we need a new product? But hey, this is an adult, a confident adult. Why would they need a sipper? They need something that everyone can use.
And so what happened when you brought this cup to your uncle?
He was really happy. He was amazed, and it really worked. I also tested it with some other patients that had more intense tremors. And it actually worked quite well even with intense tremors. So they were very happy to drink out of it.
And did he go back out and drink coffee outside?
Yes, he did.
Really?
He was extremely proud and confident about it. In fact, some of my friends as well were like, hey, I'm clumsy. I need that cup.
Yeah.
So that was also for me a really nice moment where not only Parkinson's patients, but even other people were asking for it.
So, well, one problem solved, many more to go. All this while, I was interviewing him, questioning him. And then I realized that I was getting very superficial information or just answers to my questions. But I really needed to dig deeper to get a new perspective. So I thought, well, let's observe him in his daily tasks while he's eating, while he's watching TV. And then when I was actually observing him walking to his dining table, it struck me, this man who finds it so difficult to walk on flat land, how does he climb a staircase? So he told me, well, let me show you how I do it. And then all this while I'm thinking, oh my God, is he really going to do it? Is he really, really going to do it without his walker? And then this person who could not walk on flat land was suddenly a pro at climbing stairs. On researching this, I realized that it's because it's a continuous motion. There's this other man who also suffers from the same symptoms and uses a walker. But the moment he's put on a cycle, all his symptoms vanish because it is a continuous motion. So the key for me was to translate this feeling of walking on a staircase back to flat land.
Okay, so imagine you look at a flat print. So it's flat, but it looks like it's a staircase. So it's a painted staircase that's extremely flat, but
that's two-dimensional.
It's an illusion. Exactly.
It's an illusion, I see.
It's an illusion. So the way you sketch it, it looks 3D, but it's actually just flat.
So it's like an M.C. Escher drawing, like of a staircase,
yes.
But you just draw it, and what, you put it on the ground?
What I did is I went home, and since, of course, printing a big staircase like that, it's complicated. You need a fancy printer. I just took A4 sheets and quickly stuck them with sellotape. And that's actually the prototype I quickly took to his house. And I put it in his house, and I said, okay, now walk on this.
Wait. Did he think you were nuts?
Yeah, he did, actually. He was like, what? What?
What do you...
And,
yeah.
I saw him walk on the staircase in the evening. So that was in the morning. And in the evening, I was back at his house. And I was like, okay, try walking on this now. So he did think I was nuts, yes.
So he gets to the... He has his walker, I'm assuming, right? Because he needs a walker just to walk.
Yes.
And he gets to this optical illusion, which is just looks like a staircase, but it's flat ground. And what does he do?
He just takes a while to get to the edge of this sort of optical illusion, the staircase illusion. And then he walked on it. And you could see he even lifted his walker and just walked straight on it.
Wow.
So till it lasted, he walked completely fine. And then he again got back and he froze when it ended.
So
when he used his walker again.
So he walked across these pieces of paper that looked like a staircase without the use of his walker, simply because it looked like a staircase.
Yes.
Amazing.
He was amazed as well. And you could see his wife was like, what? You walked fast on that. So, yeah.
Wow, if I had a gong, I would bang the gong and I would say, that's a simple solution.
It was. We also tested it in different parts of his house just to see if it still works, and it worked quite brilliantly.
What I wish to do is to make every Parkinson's patient feel like my uncle felt that day. He told me that I made him feel like his old self again. Smart in today's world has become synonymous to high tech. And the world is only getting smarter and smarter day by day. But why can't smart be something that's simple and yet effective? All we need is a little bit of empathy and some curiosity to go out there, observe. But let's not stop at that. Let's find these complex problems. Don't be scared of them. Break them, boil them down into much smaller problems, and then find simple solutions for them. Test these solutions, well, fail if needed, but with newer insights to make it better. Imagine what we all could do if we all came up with simple solutions. What would the world be like if we combined all our simple solutions? Let's make a smarter world, but with simplicity.
Why do you think we associate smart solutions with complexity?
I don't know, the word has just transformed from its original meaning as the digital world has evolved, you know. The moment internet came in and everything, like, smart just became something that's digital or high tech. But smart was something, I think a smart product is the moment it's connected. It's connected to the user, it's connected to a system. The principle makes it complicated, but the main thing is that it helps a user. It's intuitive, it's simple, it's effective. So that, for me, is still smart. And I think the meaning has just changed.
Aleha Saneji works as a product designer in the Netherlands. You can see her full talk, including images of that staircase illusion and coffee cup, at TED.com. On the show today, ideas about simple solutions. Coming up, two simple ways to make kids do better at school. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Stripe. For business owners, there's a lot that goes on behind every transaction. That's why Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe are here to make accepting in-person, contactless payments easier. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. No additional hardware required. To learn how, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help you grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about simple solutions to complex problems, like getting kids to do better at school. It's one of those challenges that virtually every city and every country faces. Some kids do well, and lots of kids just struggle. And there's no shortage of experts and analysts and policymakers and consultants who spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to solve this so-called achievement gap. But it turns out there may be one solution that's pretty simple. food.
All these other interventions that we're talking about, using new technologies or innovative approaches or whatever it might be, I think are all going to fall short or at least be completely under-leveraged if kids are feeling hunger pains.
This is Sam Cass. He's a chef.
And I was the former senior policy advisor for nutrition and the executive director of Let's Move in the Obama administration.
And Sam's simple idea is that if schools could provide every kid with enough nutritious food, well, those kids would obviously be healthier, but their brains would also be more attuned to learn. Here's Sam on the TED stage.
What do we think the connection is between a child's growing mind to their growing body? What can we expect our kids to learn if their diets are full of sugar and empty of nutrients? What can they possibly learn if their bodies are literally going hungry? And with all the resources that we are pouring into schools, we should stop and ask ourselves, are we really setting our kids up for success? Food is that place where our collective efforts can have the greatest impact. Let me give you two stats that seem like they're on opposite ends of the issue, but are actually two sides of the same coin. On the one hand, 1 in 6 Americans face hunger every year, including 16 million children, almost 20%. In this city alone, in New York City, 474,000 kids under the age of 18 face hunger every year. On the other hand, diet and nutrition is the number one cause of preventable death and disease in this country by far. And fully a third of the kids that we've been talking about tonight are on track to have diabetes in their lifetime. Now, what's hard to put together, but is true, is that many times these are the same children. So they fill up on unhealthy and cheap calories that surround them in their communities and that their families can afford. But then by the end of the month, food stamps run out or hours get cut at work and they don't have the money to cover the basic costs of food.
Just think about how hungry a young person is because they're growing, right? They're expending so much energy because they're growing and they're learning and their brains are taking in a lot of information and we're asking a lot of them. There's no way that a kid can learn if they haven't gotten basic nutrition. Because if you're sitting there and you haven't eaten all weekend, for example, and you show up to school and literally you're experiencing hunger pains, or you haven't eaten since lunch the last day because a lot of kids go home and there's no food in the house, you're not going to be able to do a math problem. So I think it's one of those starting points that we have to take care of their basic well-being before we can expect them to excel in the classroom.
So when you were in the Obama White House, were you guys able to make changes to solve some of those problems?
Yeah. And so one of the changes that we made was called the Community Eligibility Program, which allowed schools that had significant populations of low-income children to serve breakfast to everybody.
As part of my work at the White House, we instituted a program that for all schools that had 40% more low-income kids, we could serve breakfast and lunch to every kid in that school for free. This program has been incredibly successful because it helped us overcome a very difficult barrier when it came to getting kids a nutritious breakfast. And that was the barrier of stigma. See, schools serve breakfast before class, before school, and it was only available for the poor kids. So everybody knew who was poor and who needed government help. Now, all kids, no matter how much or how little their parents make, they have a lot of pride. So what happened? Well, the schools that have implemented this program, they saw an increase in math and reading scores by 17.5%. And research shows that when kids have a consistent, nutritious breakfast, chances of graduating increase by 20%. 20%. When we give our kids the nourishment they need, we give them the chance to thrive.
It's amazing that you change just this one thing, free breakfast, and it has this enormous impact on like health and educational outcomes.
Absolutely. Test scores tell you a very clear story. And this is common sense. We can all just test ourselves. Go 2 days without eating much or just eat a few bags of chips and then go take some kind of test.
Yeah, and see, right.
And,
yeah.
And see how you do. I guarantee you, you're not going to do that well. Kids make many more mistakes. Their cognitive ability slows down. And on the flip side, when they get the nourishment, they are much more proficient in solving problems, in comprehending reading. Their behavior goes up. Their stress levels go down. I mean, the other thing that happens when you're hungry is your anxiety naturally rises. You become more aggressive and unsettled. So it leads to a lot of other behaviors that absolutely undermine the educational experience.
I mean, all these things are connected, right? Like, if you've got a kid who is eating high fat and high sugar diet, that's what's feeding their brain, and that's what is going to feed their behavior. And then you've got a disruptive classroom, and a teacher can't teach all the kids in the classroom. Like, it's all connected.
Yep. And then it actually reverberates out even further. Then those kids get sick more frequently, which means they have to stay home, which means that their parent has to stay home from work, which has an impact on their performance at work and their productivity. And if we really focus our resources, the question is, like, if we have a few dollars to spend, what's the most impact we can have? There's not too many interventions that are going to give you, you know, 15 to 20% improvements on test scores with just a relatively small amount of increase in resources and focus around nutrition. We only see upside. We only see benefit from it. I've not seen any statistic that showed any kind of negative outcome here.
Sam Kass, he's a chef and the former senior food policy advisor at the White House under President Obama. You can see his entire talk at TED.com. So, Wendy, Sam Kass is talking obviously about food and how it could change schools. If I were to ask you to give me one idea about something that could have a huge impact on kids in schools, what would it be?
More sleep.
More sleep. That could actually have, like, measurable impact on like, how well students do at school?
Absolutely, and we have evidence to bear this out.
This is Wendy Troxell.
I'm a clinical psychologist, sleep medicine specialist, and I'm a senior and behavioral social scientist at the RAND Corporation.
And Wendy's research focuses on teenagers, so high school-age kids. And she says the results, well, they're pretty clear.
Kids who get adequate amounts of sleep perform better in school. They're more likely to show up for school on time, have better graduation rates. They're able to think and perform better. Their attention is better. Kids who are sleeping sufficient amounts also have better mental health and physical health, all of which we know goes into the factors that contribute to a whole healthy child who's able to perform and succeed in school.
Now, this may sound painfully obvious, right? Kids need more sleep. But it's not that easy, as Wendy Troxell explains from the TED stage.
Sleep deprivation among American teenagers is an epidemic. Only about 1 in 10 gets the 8 to 10 hours of sleep per night recommended by sleep scientists and pediatricians. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, phew, we're doing good, my kid's getting 8 hours. Remember, 8 hours is the minimum recommendation. There are many factors contributing to this epidemic, but a major factor preventing teens from getting the sleep they need is actually a matter of public policy, not hormones, social lives, or Snapchat. Across the country, many schools are starting around 7:30 a.m. or earlier, despite the fact that major medical organizations recommend that middle and high schools start no earlier than 8:30 a.m. These early start policies have a direct effect on how much, or really how little, sleep American teenagers are getting.
I mean, basically what you're saying is that because school starts so early for teens, and they have to wake up, you know, obviously much earlier than that to get ready for school and sometimes even get to school if they're, you know, if they're walking or taking the bus. So, of course, they're not going to get enough sleep.
Exactly. It's a simple math problem, right? if you have a school that's starting at 7:35 a.m., like my own child's, that means that they're getting on a bus between 6:30 and 6:45 a.m. often. So if you simply back up the clock, your child has to be going to bed by 10 p.m. at the latest. Mm. And that's simply not possible for most teenagers. But the truth of the matter is, all of this is truly an artifact of a decision that was made years and years ago, frankly, before sleep research was really as robust as it is today, and before we knew the consequences of sleep loss that occurs in adolescence. So we're setting them up for failure. Failure in their ability to sleep, and failure in their ability to perform well at school.
Adolescence is a period of dramatic brain development, particularly in the parts of the brain that are responsible for those higher-order thinking processes, including reasoning, problem-solving, and good judgment. In other words, the very type of brain activity that's responsible for reining in those impulsive and often risky behaviors that are so characteristic of adolescence. In fact, many of the, shall we say, unpleasant characteristics that we chalk up to being a teenager, moodiness, irritability, laziness, depression, could be a product of chronic sleep deprivation. Around the time of puberty, teenagers experience a delay in their biological clock, which determines when we feel most awake and when we feel most sleepy. This is driven in part by a shift in the release of the hormone melatonin. Teenagers' bodies wait to start releasing melatonin until around 11 p.m., which is 2 hours later than what we see in adults or younger children. This means that waking a teenager up at 6 a.m. is the biological equivalent of waking an adult up at 4 a.m.
So teenagers' biological clocks are delayed by about 2 hours.
That's correct. Sort of like how you might feel if you travel, you know, west to east and your brain still is on the West Coast time zone, but local time says, oh, well, it's locally 10 p.m., but your brain thinks it's only 7 p.m. You can't make yourself go to sleep at a time when your brain's not ready. And it's that conflict between the internal biology of adolescence and sort of clock time that poses the real problem.
So this seems like, I mean, out of all of the problems that we're talking about on the show, this seems like the easiest one to solve, like the most doable. You just change the start time of schools. You just go to schools and you say, hey, schools, you know, move your start time from 7:30 to 8:30 and you're done, right?
Yes, and I really wish it could be that easy. And yet, and if I was only a sleep researcher, if I hadn't been involved kind of with boots on the ground in districts where we've actually tried to get this done, I would have the same attitude because it should be a no-brainer. However, the truth of the matter is start times really can have ripple effects on the entire community. So there are legitimate concerns. When you shift the day later for any group of students, you have an impact on other students. And if you're dealing with a tiered bus system, somebody eventually has to go first. And people are going to get out later. So there are many implications. When we shift start times, there are impacts on after-school sports and other extracurricular activities. There's issues of care for younger children, both before and after school. There's also issues of after-school jobs and other factors such as traffic and transportation-related issues. So as much as it seems like a no-brainer, it's not as simple as it sounds.
Well, see, now I feel like you've just made a really compelling argument against your original argument. Like now I'm like, yeah, I think Wendy's wrong. Now I'm with the school districts here.
Well, then can I tell you about the consequences of early start times?
Yeah, sure,
because frankly, yes, you're right. If it was all about what's most convenient for adults, then keep the status quo, right?
Yeah.
But what we know is that when schools start later, one school district found a 25% reduction in school absences. And now school attendance is critically important for big issues like reducing the achievement gap. When we delay start times, children are actually more likely to get the bus. And for many of our low-income students or racial and ethnic minority students, if busing is their only option for transportation, if they miss that bus, they are not likely to go to school. So when we delay start times, we see an increase in attendance rates. We also see an increase in graduation rates. This has a direct impact on their lifetime earnings.
Teens from districts with later start times get more sleep. To the naysayers who may think that if schools start later, teens will just stay up later. The truth is, their bedtimes stay the same, but their wake-up times get extended, resulting in more sleep. Not surprisingly, they do better academically. Standardized test scores in math and reading go up by 2 to 3 percentage points. That's as powerful as reducing class sizes by 1/3 fewer students. Their mental and physical health improves, and even their families are happier. I mean, who wouldn't enjoy a little more pleasantness from our teens and a little less crankiness? Even their communities are safer because car crash rates go down, a 70% reduction in one district. The findings are unequivocal. And as a sleep scientist, I rarely get to speak with that kind of certainty.
I feel like this period, like the teenage period in our lives, is where our biology requires a specific schedule, right? Like it seems so obvious that we should figure this out, you know, to change our institutions and our environment to accommodate that.
Exactly. And one of the things I often hear, I hear the comment, oh, let's stop coddling our teenagers. They need to toughen up. We need to get them ready for the real world. Mm. But that's missing the point that this is a developmentally specific issue. They don't have these shifted sleep-wake schedules for the rest of their lives. It is only during adolescence. Similarly, like if you look at how you treat sleep in your younger child, we recognize that younger children have specific sleep needs, and we honor that, for instance, by allowing them to nap. We don't say, though, well, you know, this 2-year-old, well, we shouldn't let him nap because eventually he's going to be going to kindergarten and he won't be able to nap in kindergarten. We know it's developmentally specific. A 2-year-old needs a nap. You know, sleep science has clearly shown that there is this change in sleep-wake cycles such that adolescents naturally go to bed later and sleep in later. So by depriving them of sleep in adolescence, we are not doing anything to toughen them up. We're just hurting them in this critically important developmental phase. And the truth of the matter is, by trying to kind of overcome this biology and putting a start time, this indirect conflict with their biology, we're really hurting their chances for success and their health.
Wendy Troxell, she's a clinical psychologist who studies sleep. You can see her entire talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas about how simple solutions can be the answer to some of our most complex problems. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about 1/3 of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Ah, the satisfying sounds of more sales in your business. And from the sound of it, your business is growing. But you shouldn't have to pay more to scale your business. With Stamps.com, you can import orders from wherever you sell online, find the lowest rates with the fastest delivery times, and instantly deliver tracking updates to your customers and stock up on supplies. Get started at Stamps.com today with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale.
I'm Miles Parks. I cover voting and election security for NPR. Across the NPR network, we report rigorously on the forces seeking to disrupt democracy and provide communities with reliable information. It's Public Media Giving Days, the perfect time to stand with the facts by donating now at donate.npr.org. Thank you.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about how we can solve some of our most complex problems in simple ways. So one huge problem that you probably hear a lot about is that every single year, millions of children all around the world die from common diseases.
I think some of the top main killers are diarrhea and pneumonia. So diarrheal disease kills more than 500,000 children globally every year, more than HIV, AIDS, malaria, and measles combined.
This is public health advocate Miriam Sidibe.
the maximum numbers of these children are dying because of preventable disease that we can do something about.
And for the last 20 years, Miriam's been working to fix this problem. And her solution? It doesn't require a new vaccine or a massive health initiative or a huge grant from the Gates Foundation. Miriam described her simple solution from the TED stage.
What we can do to prevent this disease is one of the world's oldest inventions, bar of soap. Washing hands with soap, a habit we all take for granted, can reduce diarrhea by half, can reduce respiratory infections by one third. Hand washing with soap can have an impact on reducing flu, trachoma, SARS, and most recently, in the case of cholera and Ebola outbreak. Hand washing with soap keeps kids in school. It stops babies from dying. Hand washing with soap is one of the most cost-effective ways of saving children's life. It can save over 600,000 children every year. I think you'll agree with me that that's a pretty useful public health intervention. Statistics are actually showing that 4 people out of 5 don't wash their hands when they come out of the toilets. And the same way we don't do it when we've got fancy toilets, running water, and soap available, it's the same thing in the countries where child mortality is really high.
I mean, that's pretty surprising to me that so few people wash their hands after using the bathroom, because it seems like that idea is programmed into our brains from a very young age.
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I would say, one, the environment is not always adequate. So when you take a lot of the rural areas or areas where, you know, water supply is not always flowing out of your tap, it might be very difficult for you to make it a habit so routinely, because having water and soap at the same place is not often there. Why is it that Mayank, this young boy that I met in India, isn't washing his hands? Well, in Mayank's family, soap is used for bathing, soap is used for laundry, soap is used for washing dishes. His parents think sometimes it's a precious commodity, so they'll keep it in a cupboard. They'll keep it away from him so he doesn't waste it. On average, in Mayank's family, they will use soap for washing hands once a day, at the very best, and sometimes even once a week for washing hands with soap. What's the result of that? Children pick up disease in the places that's supposed to love them and protect them the most, in their homes. So that's one reality. Two, even though people have access to soap, and even when they have access to water, transforming it into a habit regularly is usually not found.
Okay, so how do we get people to wash their hands more often?
It needs to be transformed into social norms so that everybody, you know, is basically monitoring everybody else and checking that everybody's washing their hands. So it's about washing your hands before you eat, washing your hands after the toilets, and making sure that those are embedded into routines in the household. 9 years ago, I decided, with a successful public health career in the making, that I could make the biggest impact coming, selling and promoting the world's best invention in public health, soap. We run today the world's largest hand washing program by any public health standards. Over the last 4 years, child mortality has reduced in all the places where soap use has increased. Last week, my team and I spent time visiting mothers that have all experienced the same thing, the death of a newborn. I'm a mom. I can't imagine anything more powerful and more painful. And we know that the majority of children that actually die in the first month of their life. And we know that if we give a bar of soap to every skilled birth attendant, and that soap is used before touching the babies, we can reduce and make a change in terms of those numbers. And that's what inspires me. Inspires me to continue in this mission. And next time you think of a gift for a new mom and her family, don't look far. Buy her a soap. It's the most beautiful invention in public health.
I mean, it's amazing because we think about complicated solutions to big health challenges, right? But it does make sense in a way when you say that soap is the world's best invention in public health because it's cheap. I mean, it doesn't require refrigeration. It's It doesn't require careful transport. It can be made locally. It's available everywhere. And it's soap.
Yes, that's right. I mean, there's nothing fundamentally new about that. but what is absolutely needed is that, you know, to be thinking about what these simple solutions can have in terms of an impact into big public health issues. And, you know, it's not just soap. I mean, it's similarly the same with toothpaste and school absenteeism. And what do you do in terms of that being, you know, obviously the number one reasons for children missing out on schools. And I think ultimately that is, you know, the reasons why prevention becomes so important in some of the public health problems of today.
I'm going to go wash my hands after this, Miriam.
You should. And you should make sure that all the people around you are washing their hands, because otherwise you'll shake somebody else's hands who's now washed their hands and is back to the same thing.
I know. The whole TED Radio Hour team is going to go wash their hands right now. Okay, guys?
They should.
That's Miriam Sidibe. She's the Social Mission Director for Unilever of Africa. And we reached her at her home in Nairobi. You can see her full talk at TED.com. On the show today, simple solutions to some pretty complex problems. But the thing with simplicity is that sometimes it requires a lot of complexity to get there.
I agree.
Right?
Yeah. Because to make something simple and cheap and reliable often takes very rigorous engineering.
This is Amos Winter. He's a mechanical engineer at MIT, and his research group tries to build solutions to problems in developing countries.
And the common theme in all that we do is, even though it may look simple and be constructed of cheap, simple elements, the math and the physics and the engineering rigor that went into it was not simple.
Like one specific problem that was presented to him in Tanzania with wheelchairs.
Yeah, I spent that summer talking to wheelchair users, wheelchair manufacturers, and disability advocacy groups to get a sense of, you know, what the lay of the land was and how well current products were meeting people's needs.
And you might think, what's the problem? A wheelchair is a wheelchair. It's already a pretty straightforward, simple solution.
No. A wheelchair is not a wheelchair, depending on where you are. Hmm. Much of our country, I'd say, is ADA accessible and has been designed to meet the needs of wheelchair users. That is not the case in most other countries, particularly if you're living in a rural area. And so if you have to go a few kilometers from your house to your school or house to a job, just a small crack in the road can be a major barrier if you're using a conventional hospital-style wheelchair, which is what most people get. Typically, you would be dependent on a family member to push you around your village. But actually, even more commonly, you're probably going to be stuck in your house most of the time and maybe even viewed as a burden on your family.
Amos Winter spoke about the problem on the TED stage.
What stood out to me is that there wasn't a device available that was designed for rural areas that could go fast and efficiently on many types of terrain. So being a mechanical engineer, being at MIT and having lots of resources available to me, I thought I'd try to do something about it. Now, when you're talking about trying to travel long distances on rough terrain, I immediately thought of a mountain bike. And a mountain bike's good at doing this because it has a gear train. And you can shift to a low gear if you have to climb a hill or go through mud or sand, and you get a lot of torque, but a low speed. And if you want to go faster, say on pavement, you can shift to a high gear, and you get less torque, but higher speed. So, you know, the logical evolution here is to just make a wheelchair with mountain bike components, which many people have done. But these are two products available in the U.S. that would be difficult to transfer into developing countries because they're much, much too expensive. And the context I'm talking about is where you need to have a product that is less than $200. And this ideal product would also be able to go about 5 kilometers a day so you could get to your job, get to school, and do it on many, many different types of terrain. But when you get home or want to go indoors at your work, it's got to be small enough and maneuverable enough to use inside. And furthermore, if you want it to last a long time out in rural areas, it has to be repairable using the local tools, materials, and knowledge in those contexts.
Okay, so you have this idea for like a mountain bike kind of wheelchair. And then what do you do from there?
So I worked with a team of students at MIT through many iterations, trying to make this cheap, simple, you know, fast and efficient off-road wheelchair device to give you a low gear to climb hills and a high gear to go fast. And we failed a number of times. We could not do that with the conventional mountain bike solution because you need a chain to switch from gear to get those different gear ratios. Mm. And then about a year and a half later, I was actually back in Africa at a conference, and I was sitting there just doodling in a notebook. And I realized, boy, you know, we could get a variable mechanical advantage, you know, to get this mountain bike effect very simply by grabbing a lever at different points. Hmm. And that was the, I'd say, the real breakthrough for us, realizing how we could make a cheap, simple, bike part-based solution that would be viable in this context of developing countries.
Okay, so we're talking about simple solutions. So can you, like, simplify this and walk me through it? You thought of levers?
Yes.
Like, I'm imagining, like broom handles or, you know, like sticks on a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. How does that simplify things?
So if you're in a wheelchair, your power source is your upper body, right? And so you conventionally you'll grab the wheel or you could do some other motion that's engaging the muscles in your chest and shoulders. And so one reason I thought of levers is because it engages the largest muscle groups in your upper body, your chest muscles. And so what was nice about a lever is if you imagine a person sitting in a wheelchair, grabbing two levers in front of them, that if they are pushing forward and back on those levers, if they just shift their hands up or down a little bit, it effectively changes the length of the lever. So the distance between where their hand is and where the pivot is of the lever. So if they grab high on the lever, they get a long lever, get a lot of leverage, and get a lot of torque. If they grab low on the lever, they're able to push through a bigger angle every push, which makes the wheel spin faster.
So if they're in the wheelchair on rough terrain or going uphill, they can grab up at the top of the lever, and it's easier to get through that rocky area. And if they're on a straight path on paved concrete, they can just grab lower and go fast.
Yep, exactly.
So, I mean, this is not new technology. I mean, leverage and levers are like, this is like ancient Egypt stuff.
Yeah, and even levers on wheelchairs is ancient technology. People have done many, many different iterations of that idea. The critical factor in the critical value of our idea was that ability to shift your hands up and down the levers.
Yeah, and what's so cool about this is you're kind of taking this old technology to something that most people would think to innovate with, like mechanized changes, like making them electronic or more complex.
Yeah. And again, I have to come back to the constraints of the problem we are trying to solve. You know, think about out in a village. What parts can you service this thing with? How would you ever recharge it if it's electric? And that's what drove us to this simple, cheap solution, the leveraged freedom chair.
Now, also being engineering scientists, we were able to quantify the performance benefits of the leveraged freedom chair. So here are some shots of our trial in Guatemala, where we tested the LFC on village terrain and tested people's biomechanical outputs, their oxygen consumption, how fast they go, how much power they're putting out, both in their regular wheelchairs and using the LFC. And we found that the LFC is about 80% faster going on these terrains than a normal wheelchair. It's also about 40% more efficient than a regular wheelchair. And because of the mechanical advantage you get from the levers, you can produce 50% higher torque and really muscle your way through the really, really rough terrain. I think this project worked well because we engaged all the stakeholders that buy into this project and are important to consider in bringing the technology from inception of an idea through innovation, validation, commercialization, and dissemination. And that cycle has to start and end with end users. These are the people that define the requirements of the technology, and these are the people that have to give the thumbs up at the end and say, yeah, it actually works, it meets our needs. And this picture was taken in India in our last field trial, where we had a 90% adoption rate where people switched to using our leveraged freedom chair over their normal wheelchair. And this picture specifically is of Ashok. And Ashok had a spinal injury when he fell out of a tree, and he had been working at a tailor. But once he was injured, he wasn't able to transport himself from his house over a kilometer to his shop in his normal wheelchair. The road was too rough. But the day after he got an LFC, he hopped in it, rode that kilometer, opened up his shop, and soon after landed a contract to make school uniforms, started making money, started providing for his family again.
Do you think that most of the time the simplest solution is the best one?
I think about the word simple maybe differently than you are. Mm. I think the best solution is the best solution. And I'm so sensitive about imposing unnecessary constraints on a design problem. I try not to design in terms of simplicity. I try to design in terms of what is the solution that will give you the required performance for as little money and as little complexity as possible. And so I think the idea of simplicity that you're touching on is that, that I'm thinking about, that I don't want to overcomplicate things. I want to make things robust. I want to have as few parts as possible, but I don't want to compromise value and performance by making it cheap and simple. And so I think people will sometimes confuse like developing world technologies as low quality and cheap and not as functional. And I don't think that way at all. People have a core level of functionality they need to be met for that product to be successful. And there's a price point, and there's maybe a serviceability associated with that. And those are the design requirements you have to satisfy in order to be successful. And our wheelchair absolutely does do that.
That's Amos Winter. His wheelchair is called the Leveraged Freedom Chair. So far, his team has built about 2,000 of them. You can see his entire talk and the wheelchair at TED.com. This is a must to keep it simple. My complexion, keep it simple, my business. I keep it simple the way I walk and talk. Keep it simple the way I do it. I keep it simple. Hey, thanks for listening to our show on Simple Solutions this week. If you want to find out more about who is on it, go to ted.npr.org. And to see hundreds more TED Talks, check out ted.com or the TED app. You can also listen to this show anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can do it now on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Janae West, Neva Grant, Rund Abdel Fattah, Casey Herman, and Rachel Faulkner, with help from Daniel Shukin. Our intern is Benjamin Klempe. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Colin Helms, Anna Phelan, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.